We'll be moving along, I hope, much faster as we move through these chapters. But we are in this section where Job has a controversy with his friends. Now, I think we need to understand that these were indeed friends, and probably of the same doctrinal persuasion up until this time. As far as their understanding of God, these men all seem to have a high view of God and His righteousness and His holiness and things of that nature. They very likely were believers. Have to understand that in this period of the history of time, in the pre-Israel time, in the patriarchal is what I'm trying to say, in this patriarchal period, people had from what we know of Abraham and others, had a very strong view of God's holiness and His righteousness and His judgment and His hatred for sin. I mean, this was a period of time, and you have to understand that grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. So they didn't know about suffering like we know about suffering. Christ has come and Christ has died and suffered in our stead and paid the debt on the cross, and now we are on this side of the cross, and we look back to that, and we have that comfort, and we have that assurance, you see, which they didn't have. So we don't want to be too harsh on these men, any harsher than God is on them, and He's very, before it's over, is rather harsh on them. To begin with, certainly for their views about suffering, because to them, the only people who suffered were the wicked. See, in particular, that was just the way it was in that period of time as far as people knew that the righteous didn't suffer. They were blessed, prospered, but the unrighteous were the ones who suffered. Now, we, of course, understand a lot more about that, and Job found out about it during this period of time as well. But now, we said something about this before, but to review, it is interesting how the tone and direction of this rather lengthy section changes as we proceed through the different exchanges, and there are three different cycles. To begin with, the friends handle Job with courtesy and kindness, and at the same time, Job seems to be taken aback and unsure of himself by the many disastrous blows he has taken. As the dialogue continues, however, the friends become more and more suspicious of Job, becoming much more harsh and denunciating in their language toward him. At the same time, Job seems to become stronger as his faith takes a foothold. He seems to emerge from such deep despair and is better able to handle the attack of his friends. True faith always comes through. It always triumphs. And that's something that has always been true and is true today. A person who truly has faith, genuinely has faith, this is the victory that overcometh the world. See, even our faith. Now, as the dialogue progresses, the friends are getting farther from the light because their theology is faulty, and they refuse to recognize that Job is speaking from a position of faith, and they are wrong in their assumptions. Now, as we said, there are three cycles or three rounds in this these dialogues. Chapters 4 through 14 make up the first round. Chapters 15 through 21, the second round. And then chapters 22 through 26, the third round. Now I want to quote a couple of men at this point. And here's what G. Campbell Morgan said concerning this. In the first cycle, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar declared that God is righteous, that He punishes the wicked and blesses the good. Job answered these arguments by declaring that his own experience proved their falsity. He was righteous and yet afflicted. In the second cycle, while holding strenuously to the positions advanced in the first, they narrowed the application by declaring that it is the wicked who are afflicted. This Job answered again out of his own experience by affirming that the righteous are also afflicted, and by observation that the wicked are not always afflicted. In the third cycle, still adhering to the positions already taken up, their words were personal as they declared that Job had sinned and therefore suffered. In this case, his answer was that of a solemn protestation of innocence. Now, I have another quote I want to give from Samuel Rideout. I'm not as familiar with him, but he has some good things to say concerning this. He lists them in section 1, section 2, and section 3. He says, the first addresses of the friends their doctrine of the punitive nature of suffering and Job's despair. In the second addresses of the friends, suspicions and charges, Job rises from despair to hope. And then in the third section, the third addresses of the friends, Job silences them, but the enigma remains. The numerical significance in the two opposite directions is quite clear. The third is the full manifestation where each stands, as the first shows the beginning and the second the development. In other words, he said it starts off, the first section is they state the positions, and the second they develop their positions, and then in the third their positions are set in stone, so to speak. And we'll see that, I hope we'll see that as we read through this, but in case you don't and I don't, we'll watch for it, because these men seem to think that's what it says, and that's what I think as well. Now, the first session, Eliphaz's discourse and Job's reply. And we're going to begin here in chapter 4. We have Eliphaz's discourse in chapter 4 and 5. This is when they begin to talk to him after the 7 days and 7 nights now with nothing said. Job at this point expects comfort and understanding from his friends. See, in chapter 3, he just unburdened himself. And now he's expecting that they will comfort and understand his position. He probably is taken aback by their not believing him when he says he does not understand what is happening to him. Job's theology probably was the same as theirs prior to this. However, when trouble comes to you, you see things a lot differently. And we need to be careful how we evaluate the actions of others when they may be going through things that you have never experienced. That's one lesson I think it's important for us to learn in this, and we've mentioned this before. You know, it's so easy, you know, to kind of say, well, I don't see why they acted like that, or I don't see why they said that, or I don't see why they did such a thing as that. I wouldn't, what we're saying is, I wouldn't have done that. You know, I either more spiritual or have more knowledge or whatever, you know. But we better be careful, because we don't know what we'll go through. Not a one of us here tonight know what we will go through and how that trial and that testing or that suffering or whatever it may be will change our opinions. Not about the gospel, not about the foundational things, but about people. And not being so critical, you know, when a person obviously rejects the gospel and they obviously demonstrate that they don't have faith, then it's proper and right to say that that person is not a Christian, obviously, by their life and so forth. One of the lessons we learn from this is that we need to be careful. Now, let's go into this then. In chapter 4, verses 1 through 4, he identifies the good things that Job has done for others before he drops the hammer on him. Now, we're going to read, and we will make a comment now and again, but we want to move along. Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, "If we essay to commune with thee, wilt thou be grieved?" No. He doesn't wait for an answer. "But who can withhold himself from speaking? I'm gonna blow up if I don't say something. So too bad if you're grieved." Now, then he starts off, like all good preachers and teachers ought to do, on a positive note. If you can think of anything good to say, say it first. You know, as we said it. And he said, "Behold, thou hast instructed many, and thou hast strengthened the weak hands. Thy words have upholden him that was falling, and thou hast strengthened the feeble knees. But now it is come upon thee, and thou faintest." It touches thee, and thou art troubled. Now, this is the first thing that he goes after. He says, you have been a man of known and established righteousness. You have been good to people. You have helped people. And when people were in trouble, you stood by them and you helped them. But now the trouble has come upon you, and you're fainting. It touches thee, and thou art troubled. Is not this thy fear, thy confidence, thy hope, and the uprightness of thy ways? In other words, this can be interpreted according to verse 25 of the previous chapters we mentioned before, or it can be he's saying to them, you fear God, your confidence in God, he's your hope, and you profess him to be the uprightness of thy ways. Remember, I pray thee, whoever perished being innocent. Now, we have right here the first statement of what they're going to say over and over in different ways and stick by in this thing. And, of course, it's a wrong premise. You know, that's just what happens so many times, isn't it? If you lay down a wrong premise to start with, then you're going to, first of all, if you're like most people, proud, you got to stick by it. I said it, now I've got to live with it, and I got to back it up. How many preachers I've seen take positions that were not biblical, scriptural positions, and then as that time went on, and they obviously could see that it was a bad position, they still defend it. Because I took that position, and I can't be wrong. That's the first day. Whoever perished being innocent, or where were the righteous cut off? Even as I have seen, they that plow iniquity and sow wickedness reap the same. Now, of course, because he has made a wrong premise, he's making a wrong application of the premise. He is basically saying, that's what your problem is in this regard. And he's basing it on, as we talked about, I think mentioned this part previously before too, inductive reasoning rather than deductive reasoning. He is saying, I have seen it. I have observed it. I've saw many times the wicked suffer, and I've seen many times where the righteous came through victorious, and so I can state this thing. Now, in verses 7 through 11 here, as we said, the statement of their argument surfaces, and then he uses an illustration here of the lions. By the blast of God they perish, by the breath of his nostrils are they consumed. The roaring of the lion and the voice of the fierce lion and the teeth of the young lions are broken. He's comparing the wicked to lions who eventually have their teeth broken out. And the old lion perishes for lack of prey, and the stout lion's whelps are scattered abroad. Now, beginning with verse 12, he has a vision. Now, before we read this vision, let me say this, and I'm going to go contrary to most of the commentaries I've read about this vision, because most of the commentators think that this was a real vision, God gave it to him, and it was a vision of God. God gave it to him. Visions were a common way in which God communicated with his servants in patriarchal days. However, I do not believe God would be speaking to Eliphaz when he could have spoken to Job. Now, folks, who is the one here that God is standing behind? If God had a vision that he wanted to give one of these four, I believe he would have given it to Job. But God's silent about this thing. And I don't think that God stepped in here, as some commentators do, and gave Eliphaz a vision. He could have spoken to Job if there was something he wanted him to know. And in Job 42, verse 7, God speaks to Eliphaz directly and says, "My wrath is kindled against thee." This is what God said to Eliphaz. "And against thy two friends, for ye have not spoken of me the thing that is right, as my servant Job hath." When the Lord began to speak to Job in chapter 38, verse 2, speaking concerning these three friends, God said to Job, "Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge?" This leads me to believe that the vision of Eliphaz was not from God, but from Satan, and a further attempt by Satan to try to cause Job to doubt. As in much of what Satan says, there is a great deal of truth, so it is here. So, you know, some say, "Oh my, there's so much truth in this vision," what he said. That doesn't mean anything. I mean, nobody tries to parade error off as error. They parade error off as truth. They take a great deal of truth, mix a little error with it, and that's the potions. That's the way they pass it out. And that's the reason that sometimes Christians are so gullible. We are not to look for the good in something, but we are to look to see if there's any evil in it. See, you know, you want to know if somebody is feeding you a meal and you think they might want to poison you. You want to know how much poison is in the meal. You don't care how much steak's in it. You know, how much poison's in it. Is it going to kill me or not? Now, but let's look at this, beginning with verse 12. "Now a thing was secretly brought to me, and mine ear received a little thereof. In thoughts from the visions of the night, when deep sleep falleth on men, fear came upon me, and trembling, which made all my bones to shake. Then a spirit passed before my face. The hair of my flesh stood up. It stood still, but I could not discern the form thereof. An image was before mine eyes. There was silence, and I heard a voice saying." Now the King James here says, "Shall mortal man be more just than God? Shall a man be more pure than his maker?" But let me say this, that the word "more" is not in the originals. This is a better translation. Shall mortal man be just before God? Is it possible for mortal man to be just before God? Shall a man be pure before his maker? See, that changes it. The King James says that man is trying to be more righteous than God. But what it says is it possible for man to be just before God? Is it possible for man to be pure before God? Now, obviously, naturally, it's not. But by the grace of God, through the blood of Christ, it certainly is. Now, "Behold, he put no trust in his servants, and his angels he charged with folly. How much less in them that dwell in houses of clay, whose foundation is in the dust, which are crushed before the moth? They are destroyed from morning to evening. They perish forever without any regarding it. Doth not their excellency which is in them go away? They die even without wisdom. And as I said, there's a great deal of truth in that as to the sinfulness of man and so forth. But think of it in relationship to what it is saying to Job and how Satan always attacks the righteous with, tries to attack them with doubts, questions. He is the accuser of the brethren. And to me, this is more an accusation than it is a sound statement of doctrine or faith. But you may, as McGee says, you may agree with the others, and if you want to be wrong, that's all right. It's all right if you don't want to be right. If you want to be right, well, be with me on it. All right. Now, continuing, he makes some more observations which are inappropriate in Job's case. Call now, if there be any that will answer thee, and to which of the saints wilt thou turn? For wrath killeth the foolish, or vexation, rage, killeth the foolish man, and envy slayeth the silly man. I have seen, oh boy, what this man has seen. I tell you, he's been around. He's probably the older of the three, but not older than Job. I have seen the foolish taking root, but certainly I cursed his habitation. His children are far from safety, and they are crushed in the gate. Neither is there any to deliver them. Now remember what's already happened to Job's children. And this reference here to children probably plays, you know, into that as well. Whose harvest the hungry eateth up and taketh it, even out of the thorns, and the robber swalleth up their substance. Although affliction cometh not forth of the dust, neither doth trouble spring out of the ground, yet man is born unto trouble as the sparks fly upward. Now, I kept reading that as the sparks fly upward, and I wondered what. And I did some reading and checking and so forth in this thing. And sparks don't always fly upward, especially if you're grinding on a wheel or something. They can fly down as well. They fly, depends on which way the wheel's turning, which way they fly. This is not talking about a grinding wheel as I automatically thought, but it's talking more about a fire out in the yard where you throw some paper or something on it or ashes, you know, and they rise for the heat. They rise because of the heat. In other words, what he's basically saying is where there's smoke, there's fire. And because of his premise that he's laid out now about the righteous and the wicked. In other words, affliction doesn't just come forth out of the dust. There's cause and effect, just like the sparks go up. You see, and again, this is still his accusation against Job as far as this is concerned. Now Eliphaz advises Job to seek God. Turn his case over to him and everything will be all right. As if he hadn't done that. Now, that wasn't the case with Job. Now Job has bemoaned his lot and he's going to bemoan it some more before we get through. But this is not his problem. Verse 8, I would seek unto God, and to God would I commit my cause, which doeth great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number. Now, he's really speaking well of God as to God's greatness and his power and so forth. Who giveth rain upon the earth and sendeth waters upon the fields, to set up on high those that be low, that those which mourn may be exalted to safety. He disappointeth the devices of the crafty, so that their hands cannot perform their enterprise. He taketh the wise in their own craftiness, and the counsel of the froward is carried headlong. They meet with darkness in the daytime and grope in the noonday as in the night. But he saveth the poor from the sword, from their mouth, and from the hand of the mighty. So the poor hath hope, and iniquity stoppeth her mouth. Behold, happy is the man whom God correcteth. Therefore despise not thou the chastening of the Almighty. Now, this is where this verse comes from. It gets carried on into Proverbs, and it gets carried on into the New Testament. But this is its first use here, and it is a true statement. It just doesn't apply to Job. I mean, there's nothing wrong with a statement. Happy is the man whom God correcteth. Therefore, despise not thou the chastening of the Almighty. Well, he is not being chastened. Do you understand? See, this is the thing that we need to understand about Job's position he's in. He can't afford to admit that he sinned. He hasn't. It would be a lie to say. It'd been the simplest thing to get rid of these friends. But you see who Job is not thinking about himself as much as he is God. Now we need to understand that's faith. It is God that is on the testing stand, not Job, as far as Job is concerned. Job doesn't understand why God's doing this, but he's not going to betray him. You understand that? Job doesn't understand what's happening, but he is not going to betray God, even when he doesn't understand. Now, if we don't understand this, we miss the point of this man. Because, you see, these fellows are pouring it on. And they're peers. Now, they're not little peons that have come in here to pick at him like birds pick at something. But these are equals. These are their peers. Behold, happy is the man whom God correcteth. Therefore, despise not thou the chastening of the Almighty. Now, that is certainly when we are chastened because we sinned or because of our faults or failures. And the New Testament tells us that every son whom God receives, he chastens. And so we all receive chastening. But Job is not being chastened here. This is not a case of chastening. This is something that's going on behind the scenes that Job knows nothing about, but he's trusting God. All right? Now, the last part of this chapter, he's saying to him now, this is the chastening hand of God, and Job should not despise it. He speaks of how God deals and through chastening brings one back to himself. Job will then be in harmony with everything, all of God's creation even, as we'll see. In verse 27, he assures Job that they, the three of them, have searched or investigated his case and that his advice to Job is for his good. Now let's read this last part and we'll close for tonight. Verse 18, for he maketh sore and bindeth up. He woundeth, and his hands make whole. He shall deliver thee in six troubles, yea, in seven there shall no evil touch thee. In famine he shall redeem thee from death, and in war from the power of the sword. Thou shalt be hid from the scourge of the tongue, neither shalt thou be afraid of destruction when it cometh. At destruction and famine thou shalt laugh, neither shalt thou be afraid of the beasts of the earth. For thou shalt be in league with the stones of the field. They all of God's creation. And the beasts of the field shall be at peace with thee. And thou shalt know that thy tabernacle shall be in peace, and thou shalt visit thy habitation, and shalt not sin. Thou shalt know also that thy seed shall be great, and thine offspring as the grass of the earth. Thou shalt come to thy grave in a full age, like as a shock of corn cometh in his season. Lo, this We have searched it, so it is. Hear it, and know thou it for thy good. Now, all of that sounds so great. You know what the problem is? It doesn't apply to Job. It doesn't apply to Job. And my, you know, how much they talk of God, and a lot of their views are worthy and so forth. But we're going to see how Job answers, Lord willing, on Sunday when we pick up in chapter 6.